Yes, John Coetzee is one of the world's most lauded novelists. He's a Nobel laureate and he's won the Booker Prize twice. He was born and educated in South Africa during the apartheid era, and since then he's lived in Britain and the USA and spent 3 decades as a professor of literature back in his home country of South Africa. Now he lives in Adelaide. He's 72, and it's only now that we have a biography of him. J.M. Coetzee, A Life in Writing, is by John Kannemeyer, a professor of Afrikaans and Dutch in South Africa. Sadly, Kannemeyer died in December 2011, not after he finished writing the book. And one of the people who helped the manuscript make its way through to publication is David Atwell. David's an expert on South African literature and on Coetzee in particular. David joins us from the UK, where he's a professor of modern literature at the University of York. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Michael. It's good to be talking to you.
Let me start right off by asking about the pronunciation of our subject's name.
Yes, it's Coetzee. I think if you wanted to pronounce the name with its full Afrikaans resonance, you would have to say something like Coetzee. But John Coetzee comes from the Cape, where there's a lot of bilingualism, and I think there's a slightly English emphasis in the pronunciation of the name, so Coetzee is reliable.
And your understanding is that that's the pronunciation he prefers?
I believe so. The BBC makes that claim. They have a letter from him to that effect, so I think this is very good authority.
Well, since you're in the offices of the BBC, speaking to us here in Australia, let's go with that for today.
Right.
What was the relationship between Coetzee and John Kannemeyer?
A very interesting situation. I don't think that they had ever been colleagues or worked closely together, although they did spend a little bit of time in adjacent departments at the University of Cape Town. But John Kannemeyer was a very respected biographer in Afrikaans literature. He had done half a dozen or so biographies of major figures in the Afrikaans canon from the early 20th century to the mid-20th century. And having completed that run of biographies, he decided that he would approach John Coetzee to see whether or not he would be amenable to his writing a biography. And he did this through a mutual friend of theirs, an historian by the name of Herman Guillaume. And surprisingly, John Coetzee agreed. And I think there are a number of reasons for that. John Kannemeyer was a respected, diligent, conscientious biographer. He was known as a stickler for facts. I think that was congenial to Coetzee. And also, I think it was important that John Kannemeyer was somebody who would probably understand John Coetzee's origins, because they have a similar background as members of Afrikaans-speaking families in the Western Cape. And I think getting that story told sympathetically was important to John Coetzee. So all of those factors came together.
David, you say surprisingly he agreed to this, because Coetzee is famously reclusive. I mean, that may be putting
yes.
it too strongly, but he's shy of publicity, and he
yes.
doesn't give media interviews, which is the reason we're not talking to him. So how candid was he in the conversations that ensued after he'd agreed to this?
Yes, a good question. I agree that John Coetzee is not reclusive. Somebody who makes as many public appearances as he does to give readings can't be a recluse, but he does have a difficult relationship with the press. How accessible was he? Well, he was very cooperative with John Kannemeyer. He gave him a large number of documents to work with and agreed to a series of interviews over a week. It's not an authorized biography. I think that's important to stress. John Coetzee was very specific on this point. Nevertheless, he was willing to cooperate, the important thing being that John Kannemeyer would have to take responsibility for whatever he produced. John Coetzee did not provide access to all of his papers. There are private papers in his possession which don't come into the biography. But nevertheless, he was very generous with all of his business correspondence. So the story of John Coetzee's authorship is very well told in the biography. And it's a very large and substantial and very interesting body of information that John Kannemeyer has put together for the first time.
So let's sketch in some of these details just to give the listener a taste of what they're in for in this book. So the early life of Coetzee in South Africa, is it a happy childhood we're looking at?
No, and this is one of the reasons why the biography is so interesting and so important. You know, it's very clear that John Coetzee's life has not been easy. The childhood was difficult. His father's law practice failed twice, so the family was not well off by any means. They had to rely on his mother's earnings as a primary school teacher. And the bond with the mother was very strong as a result. So if a childhood of some hardship, actually, with a father who could not make a success of his professional life in any sense. And then in his mature years, John Coetzee has had a lot of anguish. He's a man who's experienced all kinds of sorrow, and that certainly comes through in his writing. There's the death of his son Nicholas, his daughter is very unwell living in Cape Town, the death of his first wife, Philippa, his parents passing. Then as well, you know, his own personal life, which has involved an attempt to immigrate and then being forced back to South Africa because he was not able to get a permanent residence in the United States. All of these things have come together in a life that has actually been, has had more than its fair share of anguish. So that story is told sympathetically and respectfully in the biography, and of course it all has consequences for the way we read his fiction.
So you've got this life which, as you say, is so full of anguish and unfair turns of events.
Yes.
But then it's all read against this bigger anguish, this bigger story, as it inevitably would be because he's a South African and a white South African,
yes,
against the,
yes,
story,
absolutely,
of apartheid. So
yes,
when does he first register the cruelty of apartheid? As a boy, I,
yes,
mean, when does it first dawn on him?
Yes, well, he has written a series of memoirs, let's call them autobiographical fictions. And the first of these, called Boyhood, tells the story of a period of his life when he was living with his family in the rural town of Worcester in an Afrikaans-speaking community, attending a dual medium school, both English and Afrikaans. And he becomes aware then of the cruelty in the culture around him. And that story is told with lots of very affecting detail. And then in the subsequent memoirs, the wider social context becomes even more graphic and rich and painful and interesting. The other memoirs being called Youth and more recently Summertime. So he registers the cruelty of the culture at a very early stage. But then with his fiction, you know, he's not a writer that's taken strong public positions. Nevertheless, he has registered the pain of the society that he's been in very deeply, etched into almost every word of his fiction. And it's all, you know, the historical context that he's been working in South Africa is all there. It's just not there in acts of grandstanding commitment.
In 1955, he was just 15, and he heard Bach for the first time, and this,
yes,
was a pivotal experience for him.
Yes, and the reason that comes up in the story is that he turns back to this moment in his mature years in order to try to understand the appeal of what he calls the classic in his work. I mean, he is a writer who's affiliated himself to the European tradition. He is steeped in the European novel and in European intellectual history. And he interprets, at least in his early fiction, up to and including Disgrace, he interprets the South African scene through that lens, through the lens of European modernism with all of its antecedents in European culture. So the Bach moment is one in which he begins to try to understand why it is that as a teenager growing up in Cape Town, the appeal of this courtly music should have been so powerful on his feelings and his affect and his cultural ambitions. I mean, that's why that moment is so iconic in his story.
And does that mean that he starts to think at that stage of Europe as the center and of South Africa, which is his home, as provincial?
Well, I think, you know, if you grow up in the 1950s in a country like South Africa, and I'm sure this is also true of Australia, it was inevitable that you began to that you would think of the United Kingdom as of Europe broadly as a cultural home, and you would want to interpret yourself through your reading, and your reading would be largely European. So his work has involved a process of coming to terms with that split subjectivity, if you like. You know, he only begins to write fiction when he has worked out for himself that he's going to have to be honest with himself and his background. So his first published work of fiction, Dusklands, is a very intense act of self-confrontation, I think, and a confrontation with his origins. So when he starts writing fiction, he certainly is engaging with his South Africanness. But then he has always brought the two things together. I don't think he's ever sought to turn his back on his education and his wider cultural affiliations, while at the same time addressing himself to what it means to live in South Africa with its particular history.
On RN, you're with Michael Cathcart on Books and Arts Daily, and we're talking about the new biography of James Coetzee, Coetzee, as some of us say, which is by John Cannemeyer. But John Cannemeyer died before the book could be published, and one of the people who helped the book actually come into being is David Atwell, who's an expert on Coetzee, and he's talking to us from York in Britain. Where else would York be? about this biography. So when did he decide to become a writer?
John Coetzee's answer to that question is a very interesting one. He says, actually, on the 1st of January 1970. So unlike many writers who would say, I started writing in a creative writing class at university, or when I was sitting in the little town library imagining myself elsewhere, whatever the case might be, that's his answer. And it's not entirely true. Of course, he had experimented with poetry for some years, and he had written one piece of prose, I believe, in the 1960s. But as a New Year's resolution, he sat down on the 1st of January, 1970, in the basement of his house in Buffalo, New York, which is where he was teaching at the time, and he decided that he was going to produce 1,000 words and keep doing so every day until he had a manuscript. He goes on to say that that the 1,000 words were soon revised down to 300, but the commitment remained fast, actually, and that's when this career was launched.
Well, we've leapt ahead in his story, so let me just sketch in what we've missed out. So he went to university in South Africa, and he basically did a classic, what we would call an arts degree. He studied literature, right. T.S. Eliot, Ezra Pound, Henry James, Maupassant, Conrad, Ford, Madox, Ford. He then went to London, where he seems to have had rather a melancholy, miserable time, if his novel Youth is to be believed. But he did write a M.A. thesis on Ford, Madox, Ford. He goes to America, accompanied by his then wife, Philippa, and he's there for 3 years. And it's in that second to last year, 1970, that he decides to become a writer. And I guess he's just finished his PhD on Samuel Beckett at that stage.
Yes. Well, he goes to the United States first in 65, it was, as a Fulbright student, first of all to the University of Texas at Austin, where he joins the PhD program in linguistics and literature. And I think what was happening there is that before committing himself to writing, Coetzee wanted to extend his resources a little bit. And it's very interesting that he should choose to study linguistics, because he is a writer who's very conscious of his mode of address and of his linguistic materials. So it's a rigorous kind of apprenticeship that he was committing himself there. But then towards the end of the PhD program, he secured a job at SUNY Buffalo and went up there to start a lectureship. And his years in Buffalo were very happy. He saw himself staying on in the United States, in fact. And it's very clear that at this stage of his life, he was certainly wanting to turn his back on South Africa and move on. You know, he was definitely on the path of emigration at this point. And then he was forced back to South Africa when he got arrested in a demonstration on the Buffalo campus. It wasn't exactly an anti-Vietnam War demonstration. There were such demonstrations going on. But in his particular case, what happened was that a group of 45 faculty conducted a sit-in outside of the university president's office to protest about the fact that the police were on campus and that the academic program had ground to a halt and that the whole climate was uncivil. And he and his colleagues wanted the university president to come out and talk to them and address the situation in a more rational way. And for their pains, this university president, whose name suggestively was Regan, had them all arrested. And the consequences for most of the Americans there would have been trivial, I would think. But for Coetzee, who was trying to get permanent residence, this was a disaster.
Oh, so it's not an anti-Vietnam demo, it's a pigs off campus demo.
Exactly. That's quite right, yes.
I'm sorry to use that language, but that was
the
language
absolutely.
That
was used, was the story.
Was used at that time. So it's ironic, right, isn't it, that a man who has eschewed politics should have his destiny determined by a political demonstration.
Isn't that interesting? Yes. And of course, from a South African point of view, you know, we look back at this story and we say, well, that university president had in his power the making of a Nobel Prize winner. Because I think if Coetzee had not been forced back to South Africa, then he would not have produced the kind of fiction that he produced. He was forced back to a country that he was trying to leave, a country that he knew intimately, country that's in his blood and marrow, in his fingernails, as it were, and he brought back there all of the resentment of having to be there, and all of his learning and cosmopolitan education, and it's out of that love-hate relationship with his home that this remarkable body of early fiction began to evolve. And of course, it just wouldn't have happened if he had not been there on the spot.
And he embraces it. He's there for 30 years.
Yes, that's right. There's a rootedness in South Africa and in the Western Cape in particular that was just part of his makeup. And that intimacy was always important to him. And he works through it in the course of writing those early novels, Dusklands, In the Heart of the Country, even Waiting for the Barbarians, which is known as a novel that is set in this very remote, unspecific, ahistorical milieu. I've been able to see the manuscripts recently, and he starts writing a novel about Cape Town and then shifts the milieu because he can't quite get hold of the narrative that he's searching for. And it's only when he shifts it to an unspecific place and time that he's able to get the novel launched and find the mode of address that he's looking for. But it starts in Cape Town. So all of this early fiction is really an attempt to process the implications, the philosophical, the moral, the identity implications and questions of his origins and his roots.
And to what extent are we talking about autobiography here?
Well, he has said all writing is autobiography. So of course, he adds that that all autobiography is also fiction. So there's a corollary to that statement, and you need to see both statements together. As soon as you start writing your story, you have to rely on narrative positioning and structuring, and you have to be selective and so forth. So although all writing is autobiographical, all writing about the self has to be partly fictionalized, and it's in that rather ambiguous space that a lot of his writing evolves.
Well, it's an elusive game that novelists like to play. You know, now you see it, now you don't. This is fact, this is fiction game.
Yes.
I mean, historical authors do the same thing, don't they?
Yes, that's true. Yes.
They'll tell you when you get cross with them because they've made things up. They say, of course I've made up, it's a novel. And then the next minute they're telling you that they're seeing into the heart of their character in a way that history, they're always saying, wouldn't be able to do. What was the first book that really won him international recognition?
It was, in fact, Waiting for the Barbarians. And very interestingly, I think initially that book acquired its stature through word of mouth, really. You know, I think his reputation grew in the literary world before people really, before the celebrity industry got hold of his story. So I think he earned his stripes, as it were, on the basis of the quality of his writing, and it became manifest to an international readership in Waiting for the Barbarians. I should say that with Dusklands, it was immediately apparent from the very beginning that this was an extraordinary writer. It was an explosive, challenging, highly modernist, highly wrought text, which opened up the archive of colonial history to all kinds of parodic, very angry, textual reinvention. And I in fact was required to study Dusklands at university in 1975, you know, in a year after it had been published. So its reception in South Africa was immediate, but an international reception came a little later with Waiting for the Barbarians.
On Books and Arts Daily, my guest is Professor David Atwell, and we're talking about the life and times of J.M. Coetzee because there's a biography of him out now. Let's jump forward 20 years and talk about Disgrace, which
yes.
I guess is the novel that brings him to huge prominence, certainly here in Australia. Everyone suddenly seemed to be reading Disgrace in 1999.
Yes, of course, and you made a film of Disgrace too. It was an Australian project that produced the film.
Indeed it was. It won the Booker Prize, and it also won the Commonwealth Writers' Prize. And it's the first novel, or his first novel, set in post-apartheid Africa, and it tells the story of a divorced university professor who leaves Cape Town in disgrace after having an affair with a student to stay with his daughter on her small country property. And later his daughter is brutally raped by a group of black boys. And it presents a fairly bleak view, you'd have to say, of the possibility of whites living in South Africa after apartheid. Not everyone liked the novel for its coldness. I mean, some people thought it was quite a racist book.
Yes, there was that reaction in South Africa, not uniform by any means. Yes, it's true. It doesn't present a sympathetic picture of post-apartheid South Africa at all. It presents a picture of South Africa as having to work out some very deep-seated psychosexual issues that linger from the colonial past, and that it will not take the raising of a new flag or the signing of a new constitution to overturn that all of that history. You know, he's a psychological realist in that sense, in showing that it will take generations for these issues to work themselves through. So that was the position it takes. Insofar as the novel is an account of South Africa, I think it's many other things as well. But that has been the most controversial part of the novel. The part of the novel that I reacted to strongly in this particular sense is that it really takes no interest in South Africa's efforts to reconstruct itself. You know, you reading that novel, you would have no sense that there'd been a new constitution written, for example. And although there is some elusive reference to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, that process of the society trying to come to terms with itself and rewrite the social contract, as it were, is just not reflected in the book at all.
And what does that tell you? Because that's such an important part of the public conversation in South Africa at that time.
Yes, yes. It tells me that Coetzee was deeply dismayed about the prospects for the country over the next generation or two. You know, that's what it tells me, that he was not going to cast in his lot optimistically with these gestures, although he has made statements from time to time in which he clearly admires them. But I think when it comes to writing fiction which engages with the deep psychology of the country, I think he was inclined to be more pessimistic.
So he came to Australia in 2002, and Adelaide is now his home. What prompted that move?
Well, there are many people, certainly in South Africa, who think that the reason he went to Australia was because of Disgrace and the reaction that it produced in the ANC. And I think that's a very simplistic reading of the situation. I think there's a whole complex of reasons for his moving to Australia. We should remember, first of all, that he'd been trying to emigrate for a very long time. And when he retired as an academic from the University of Cape Town, he was looking for a peaceful retirement, and I think Adelaide fitted the bill. He had been visiting Australia for at least a decade before then, Adelaide in particular. And I think the city is very congenial to him. It is, after all, a beautiful place. And I think that that the natural environment around Adelaide and the home that he has built there is gorgeous, actually. And I'm not surprised that he feels contented there. And he has said that he didn't so much leave South Africa as go to Australia. So I think there were more pull factors than push factors, if I can put it that way. The spat with the ANC over Disgrace, I think, was symptomatic of a more general condition, which is that South Africa demanded so much of him. You know, it was always on his case about something, and I think that the distance is something that he values and appreciates. You know, he's left in peace largely in Adelaide, And I think this is also reflected in the writing that he's done since he's been in Australia.
Well, there have been several novels, the Australian novels, Elizabeth Costello's Slow Man, Diary of a Bad Year, Summertime. There's a new novel about to appear, I gather, called The Childhood of Jesus.
Yes, very exciting.
What do we know about that?
Not a lot, but it seems to be an invention based on that period of Christ's life between the Christmas story and the time when he turns up in Jerusalem answering questions in a sophisticated way in the temple, about which we know very little. So Coetzee has invented a childhood that fits that phase of Christ's life, but he's not set it in Palestine. He set it in an unspecified time and country, which is recognizably contemporary, where people are speaking Spanish, although Spanish is not the home language of anyone. So the implication seems to be that we're all adjusting to a situation in which our language is translated for us. Nobody has a natural language, as it were. We'll have to see how it all evolves.
We will just have to see, David. No point speculating
it's
anymore.
An interesting allegory.
David, it's been a lovely conversation. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
David Atwell is an expert on South African literature and on J.M. Coetzee in particular, and he's a professor of modern literature at the University of York. J.C. Kannemeyer's biography is called J.M. Coetzee, A Life in Writing, and it's published in Australia by Scribe. On Radio National, this is Books and Arts Daily with Michael Cathcart. Next up, we review two long-awaited novels with Chris Flynn.